Wednesday, January 12th, the day of the State of the Union. It's as full of tension as an opening night, as fraught with unpredictability as a birth. In 1964, we lived through it on the tidal wave of emotion produced by the assassination of President Kennedy, supported by that adrenaline of determination that such catastrophe pours into your blood. In 1965, we were on the crest of the unbelievably great victory of the November election, bolstered, assured, the people behind us, a sort of a peak in our lives, perhaps. And here, in 1966, maybe we are in the trough of a wave. Attrition and frustrations have set in, and now is the time for just dogged toughness. I kissed Lyndon goodbye and Godspeed. Then we had our breakfast, and his staff began to come into the room. Jack, Jake, Marvin. The night before, I had read the final domestic draft. I'd written in a little sentence about thrift and common sense in the conduct of the war on poverty, due respect for spending the taxpayers' dollar. So I deliberately wanted to remove myself from the brawling center of things today. I had asked Mrs. Astor, who had given $10,000 to the Committee for a More Beautiful Capital, to come down and bring her planner, her landscape gardener, who had helped her do the two wonderful projects in New York, and, of course, Mary Lask. I spent the morning at the beauty parlor. Then at 12, Brooke Astor, Mr. Simon Brines, Mary, and Liz all convened with me for tomato juice or sherry in the West Hall. And then we went downstairs for lunch. The fire was burning merrily, though the view out to Lafayette Park was gray and bleak. I reminded Brooke that this was just the sort of day I had come to see her projects in New York. Most unfair, like insisting on seeing the baby when it has the chicken pox. Parks and flowers and shrubs are beautiful only to those with imagination in a gray January. We had a delicious lobster Newberg lunch and talked about Brooke's projects in Harlem, and now the larger one, Reese. Then Nash Castro and Walter Washington joined us, and we all crowded into a station wagon. Eight of us, counting Liz and my Secret Service man, drove down to see the lovely planting of Magnolia selangiana on Pennsylvania Avenue down toward Anacostia, and then to Buchanan School, where, lo and behold, the District of Columbia, I wonder if it could possibly have been prodded by our frequent visits, and Kay Graham of the Post. Anyway, the district had budgeted a sizable amount for repairs and crews of workmen, putting in hundreds of window panes protected by heavy screens that unhappily give it an almost jail-like appearance, and painting and repairing woodwork. Walter was uncertain what, if anything, had been allotted for planting, and there does remain that perfect corner with some trees on it, which could be a charming sort of a little playground, maybe within our budget. Then we drove by Payne School and Chamberlain and Bowen. Here we got out of the car and walked around over Landsberg Park, a new area being developed by, I believe, the District of Columbia. Along very modern lines, mounds, the beginning of a pergola, several dozen trees had gone in. It lies in a wide open space, with a school on one side, several public housing projects, one named, I think, for Senator Kappa of Kansas, and privately owned apartment houses, a heavy concentration of people, a large, promising area of open space just waiting to be further developed. Unfortunately, it would run into many thousands to do it right, quite beyond our abilities. We drove round and round Buchanan School. We looked at Haynes Point across the river, dreamed of the weeping cherries bending into the water some future spring. We traversed Pennsylvania Avenue to see Mary's azaleas, which do seem to have grown in the 9 short months they've been in. And finally, we landed back at the White House for tea in the Red Room around a fire about 3:30. Brooke had to catch a plane, and time was short. We rather ruefully agreed that all each school had in the way of a playground was a mighty fine fence, a steel mesh hurricane-type fence about 9 or 10 feet high, enclosing a barren wasteland, often cement, thousands of dollars worth of fence, and only tens of dollars worth of one or two drooping swings or seesaws. Next, we thought we ought to take one school and try to make a good pilot project out of it. That is, plant it all the way around, at least. Up to now, we've only been doing the front, or the most important side. Putting in playground equipment of the outdoor living room type Brooke has used in her two projects is probably beyond the means of our society. We decided to finish Jefferson School, a particular accent on the rather handsome side, the colonial front that is the library annex. And I believe we'll put in conventional, less expensive playground equipment there, at any rate, one finished product. And Brooke agreed to ask the draftsman for her projects. It appears that Mr. Brines is the designer, the thinker, to come down and give us a proposed plan for one of these areas. And then, after an exciting half day full of good talk and good projects and high hopes and little real productivity, I went upstairs and tumbled into bed very sleepy and began to sign mail and take the questions and reports from Patsy and Ashton. Patsy had been taking around on a very special tour and tea the Harry Jerzigs from San Antonio, whom I had seen the night before. He had won the State of Texas Award and had come to the National Wildlife Federation banquet. It was nearly 6:30 when Lyndon came in for lunch, bringing some staff with him. What a day it must have been. We were to go to the Capitol separately, I going on ahead, but Lucy and Pat and the staff wives, whom I'd asked to sit in the gallery with me, Mary Bundy, and amazingly enough, I heard it was the first time she had ever been to a State of the Union speech in her 5 years in Washington. How glad I am, I asked her. There were so many reasons to. First, I liked them both so much. Next, he'd been one of the Paul Revere writers for peace in these last few weeks, had worked magnificently on the speech. And last, and very sadly, they will be leaving soon. So this is a part of saying goodbye. And I asked Marion Watson, Trudy Califano, and Mary Margaret. I didn't stage manage my arrival well, getting there before the House had actually been called into session. Some 5 or so minutes or so, probably before they were expecting me, and therefore the standing ovation, which the First Lady usually gets, didn't have the showmanship it might have. But it's always a night of great drama. First and foremost for me, I like to look down at the faces below me. So many we've worked with and loved through the years. Dick Russell sitting close to Mike Mansfield on a front row. The comfortable, happy countenance of Hale Boggs. And it was exactly from his direction that I heard the clapping beginning each time as the evening wore on. And there was a pang, a sort of a salute, when my eyes came to young Harry Byrd, and not the Senator Harry Byrd I've known so many years. In my gallery, I had asked the ladies to join me, who'd been covering these 40 countries for Lyndon, in this Herculean appeal for peace. Dorothy Goldberg on my right, next Marie Harriman. She leaned over and seemed quite pleased to be there and said this was the first State of the Union message she had heard since Truman's time. Next, Mary Bundy, and then Mary Lasker, and then Martiana. She and Tony were to have arrived in town the next day, and I had phoned them to see if they'd like to come a day early and be present at a State of the Union. Lucy sat by me on the aisle, and Tony beside her, very dignified and quite distinguished looking, I thought. Behind them were Nancy Mann and Nancy Williams, and behind them Pat, and then on folding seats in the back, the Roger Stevens, who's traveling, working, speaking, representing this administration to all art groups in the country in a tireless, selfless manner. There's no doubt about it, the State of the Union message, for better or for worse, is always one of the great shows of the year. Fishbate Miller announces with pomp and ceremony, each in his order files in, diplomatic corps, year by year growing more drab and Western in their dress. Only one African nation ambassador this time could I spot in his flowing native robes, and the Supreme Court, and the President's Cabinet, and then finally, the President of the United States. And we all rose as Lyndon came down the aisle, walking briskly, smiling to right and left. It is always an endurance contest for me. I wonder what it is like to him. There were some strong reassurances in it. We would go on with the great society to carry forward with full vigor the great health and education programs enacted last year. A line I loved, to meet the growing menace of crime in the streets. There were some surprises. A proposal for a 4-year term for the House of Representatives. It must have been one bit of a bombshell to help nations trying to control population growth by increasing our research and by earmarking funds to help their efforts. One of the best lines was, "We must change to master change." What I liked most of all was a clear recital of the enormous effort we had made in the last weeks of 65 for peace. 300 private talks for peace in Vietnam with friends and adversaries. For 20 days now, we have dropped no bombs in North Vietnam. Top emissaries have visited 40 countries, including talking to the Pope. We have talked to more than 100 governments and informed the United Nations and called upon its members to help toward peace. The speech had begun with about 7,000 words in its almost final form. It had to be hewed down to 4,000 to compress it within the hour. That is drastic surgery. Even so, I could hear him hurrying too fast in the first portion, I thought. In the last portion, the delivery was great. It was a cold, lethargic audience. It is true, there were about 57 applauses. They were not roars of enthusiasm by any means. Almost no participation by the Republicans. After all, this is 66, an election year. And I must say I watched in vain for approval from old friends, Dick Russell, Senator McClellan, scant occasional expression from Senator Mansfield. Then it was over. Within the hour, I breathed a sigh of relief, although there's nothing that reassures me it will be an easy year or a good year from listening to the State of the Union or from looking at the Congress in front of me. I went down to the Speaker's office. There I met Lyndon and kissed him, wishing I could convey solace and reassurance with it. And we shook hands all around, the usual first of the year, warm greetings. But even so, there was a little bit of the hilarious atmosphere missing from that normal social interchange. Or am I imagining? Then back to the White House once more, round mountain fashion. That is, the women in one car and Lyndon following in another. Marvin, Jack, Joe Califano, Mac, George Bundy, and Jake came in with Lyndon. We all had drinks, even Lyndon forsaking his diet grape for a scotch, thank goodness. We got Zephyr to cut up our steak into small bits and serve it with hot biscuits as an hors d'oeuvre, and that was dinner. And there was much talk, and finally, the new year is really on its way. I sat next to Mac George a moment. He talked about the speech. He thought it was great, he said. I was sorry to see any portion of his deleted, but it had to come from 7,000 to 4,000. He said, "It's wonderful the way the president has been working this past week, listening to everybody, considering all problems and sides and alternatives." He said, "I was worried about him last fall." I said, "What do you mean? Were you afraid he would die?" He laughed and said, "No, death is not in him. I was afraid he wouldn't feel like working as he had been before. But he does. He's just been great." I went to bed feeling this was not a triumph, not one of the greatest ones, but I was proud of it. And a last thought before I drifted off to sleep was a funny one. In our enthusiastic discussion in the Red Room, Barry, Brooke, Walter, Nash, and I, we'd gotten to talking about the shortages of labor for park maintenance and highway beautification and nurserymen, and about the shortages of plant material itself. And Mary said, with an absolutely straight face, "How are we going to get the nurserymen to have enough stock to plant the whole United States?" That's the way it is. Controversy and trivia one day, and enthusiasm like a sailboat racing before the wind the next.